Well, we are going through the book of Romans, and in some ways, the book of Romans is like the Mount Everest of the Bible, and I am never going to go up the Everest in my life, I can promise you that. And I've actually never preached all through the book of Romans. I've preached from parts of it, but I thought at this, what I hope is a mature stage of ministry, that I can actually scale this amazing mountain peak by His grace and share it with you. There is nothing that is more noble, there is nothing that is more exhilarating, I don't think, in all the Bible than to read the book of Romans. I encourage all of you to read it and to immerse yourself in it. Again, this is the 500th year of the Reformation. And if you don't know what the Reformation is, you need to find out. It's the day when started when a monk, the monkiest monk who ever monked, as somebody said, discovered the gospel, discovered that it wasn't through his works, but through the righteousness that was available to him through Christ, that he could be reconciled to a holy God. And it created a ripple effect that went all over Europe, and we are still experiencing the effects of that ripple today. There's a book by Eric Metaxas that I will recommend to you. It's number 7 on the New York Times book list, and it's just called Luther. And so if you want to understand the Reformation, that's another resource that I would recommend to you. Well, we've come today to chapter 3, and so I want you to take your Bibles. It's on the screen in front of you, but I think it would be even better for you to have an open Bible before you. And so we're going to look today at Romans chapter 3, verses 9 to 20. So follow along as I read. What then? Are we Jews any better off? No, not at all. For we have already charged that both Jews and Greeks are under sin, as it is written. There is none righteous, no, not one. No one understands, no one seeks for God. All have turned aside, together they have become worthless. No one does good, not even one. Their throat is an open grave. They use their tongues to deceive. The venom of asps is under their lips. Their mouth is full of curses and bitterness. Their feet are swift to shed blood. In their paths are ruin and misery. And the way of peace they have not known. There is no fear of God before their eyes. Now we know that whatever the law says, it speaks to those who are under the law, so that every mouth may be stopped and the whole world may be held accountable to God. For by the works of the law, no human being will be justified in his sight, since through the law comes the knowledge of sin. And this is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. Well, when you read the book of Romans, it can in many ways feel like culture shock. Now, this is an international church. We have a lot of people from a lot of different countries, so almost everyone here knows what culture shock is like. And so every year when I come back in the summer, middle of the summer, it's usually about 35 degrees centigrade. It's hot, it's miserable. And a lot of people are traveling, and so I come back, and there's always this sense of dislocation. And it takes a while to get reoriented. I mean, actually, I have been here so long, 9 years, going on my 10th year, that I actually find that there's greater culture shock when I go back to America. I've become so Taiwanese. And so I think similarly, when we come to the Bible, and we come to the book of Romans, it can feel like culture shock. And the reason that it feels like culture shock is it seems so different than everything that we experience in the world. What do we experience in the world? Well, everything, is about performance-based acceptance. I mean, your families, you know, your extended families, your employer, your teachers, and everything else, that if you perform, you are accepted and you are rewarded. And so you come to the Bible and it says just the opposite. And so there's a sense of dislocation. There's a sense of, in our hearts, we can read it, and yet in our hearts, not believe it. And the problem is there are many people in churches who call themselves Christians, even evangelical Christians, that they have never really understood the gospel very well. I think you could say, as we said last week, there are vast numbers of people in Taiwan, vast numbers of people in America and the Western world, where there are people who espouse the name of Christ and they have no clue what Romans talks about. And so we need to spend time with it. Because what I want to propose in this series of messages is that if you understand it, it will rock your world. It will change everything. For Luther, it was like the penny dropped. It was like the opening of the door to paradise. And there are millions of people down through the ages who have experienced it. And I want you to experience it as well. And it's not something that just comes in a moment. The gospel is like a many-faceted diamond. All kinds of facets to it. And you can never plumb the depths of it. There is nothing in your life to which it does not have application. And so my goal for all of you is that all of you that you would experience the power of the gospel. In Romans chapter 1, he says that the gospel is the power of God unto salvation to everyone who believes, to the Jew and also to the Greek. And where it wants to take us and where I want to take you in this series of messages is I want us at the end of it to be able to say that in some fashion I am beginning to live a cross-shaped life. Do you hear what I said? A cross-shaped life. Everything centers on the cross of Jesus. Paul says in another place that he has come to a place where he boasts in nothing except Jesus Christ and his Lordship. If you get this message, it will change the way you live. It will change how you work. It will change how you view relationships. If you're a single person, how you date. If you're married, how you parent, how you relate in your marriage. It will change the way you relate to the world. And so that's why, even though some of these passages are a bit difficult to understand, I hope that you stay with me. I hope that you stay alert. That you don't just doze off and not fail to pay attention, not to my words, but to the words that are here in this scripture. I have seen so many lives changed. We had membership testimonies. And as I listen to the testimonies in their own way, they are just another example of the power of the gospel. And it's for everyone. I remember back when I pastored, for some guys, they go, this just doesn't fit. I'm a tough, hard-nailed business guy. I live in the rough and tumble of the business world. I have no clue how this works. Well, I want to tell you it does work. I remember years ago in one of the first churches that we pastored, it was out in the western part of South Dakota, and there was a family there. They're still some of the best friends we have in the world, and their kids are like our kids, and our kids are like their kids. And I remember meeting them, and it was Fred and Phyllis and their lovely children. And I remember them telling the story. Fred was a tough guy. He was a miner. He worked in a little town in western South Dakota called Deadwood. That's a tough town. That's the town where Wild Bill Hickok and Calamity Jane came from. Those of you who are Taiwanese don't know those names. But they were the gunslingers, they were the cowboys, they were the miners, and Fred was a tough guy. He was a miner. He would get up early in the morning and he would go down into the mine and he would labor there. And Fred was an intimidating guy. But he had a wife who loved him, prayed for him. And in the early part of their marriage, like a lot of young men who get married, he was still kind of living the old kind of life. He was going out with the old friends, and he was drinking, and he was developing a drinking problem. And he was becoming a bit difficult in the home, as always takes place. But he had a lovely wife who just prayed and loved him to the very end, a woman who made a great impact upon my own children by the way she taught Sunday school and everything else. And early in their marriage, after some of these difficulties arose, out in the western plains of South Dakota, there was an associate evangelist from the Billy Graham Crusade who came to that little community and gave a crusade. And during that crusade, Fred came to the crusade. And every time, of course, at the end of the Billy Graham messages, there is an invitation to come to Christ. And Fred came forward to receive Christ. And that night, about 2 o'clock in the morning, his children were awakened. They could hear their father sobbing in his bedroom. And they said, they went to their mom and said, "Mom, Mom, Mom, why is Dad crying?" And Phyllis said to them, "Your dad is coming to Jesus." And it did. It changed his life. He was still the same kind of tough guy that he was before, but it changed his parenting. It changed his marital relationship. It changed everything. And so again, why do I share these stories? Because again, I want you to get it. And it's countercultural. It goes against all of your normal suppositions. It is the deep magic. Remember that phrase, those of you who are C.S. Lewis fans? You remember the lion, the witch, and the wardrobe? Do you remember Aslan? Do you remember the white witch? How is Narnia saved? In the strangest way imaginable, when Lion, the great Christ figure, presents himself to the white witch and offers himself to be laid upon the stone table and killed by the evil forces of Narnia. And it's a picture of Christ's death. It's a picture of Christ's resurrection. It's referred to there as the deep magic. And I would say that what we have just read in our reading in these passages is the deep magic of the gospel. I read The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe to my little granddaughters in Texas before I came back in August. And one of my little girls, Junie, she's only 3 years old. She just so loved that story. And so her dad came to me and said, "Oh, she's taking the book with her to bed at night." And I said, "Really?" "Yeah." And then last week, Katie emailed me and said, "Well, Junie's out in the neighborhood and they're all reenacting The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe." That was a good day. Because it points those little children to the gospel. It points them to Romans, and that's what I want to point you to as well. That's a long introduction. But I want to share with you 3 points from this passage. First of all, the reality of our depravity, the equality of our depravity, and finally, the cure for our depravity. 3 points. That's usually the way we go, isn't it? The reality of our depravity, the equality of our depravity, and finally, the cure of our depravity. Well, first of all, let's look at the reality of our depravity. It's all over the passage, but verse 10 gives us this shocking truth about ourselves. It's not pretty. It says that there is none righteous, no, not one. No one understands or seeks for God. All have turned aside together. They have become worthless. No one does good, not even one. Now again, I know as we read this, we go, really? You know, all have sinned, all have turned aside, all are worthless, no one does good, not even one. And he says there is nobody who seeks for God. I mean, maybe our first reaction when we read this is we go, you know, good grief, what's the matter with Paul? I mean, did he get up on the wrong side of the bed today? Did he not have his coffee? Or, you know, did God get up on the wrong side of the bed that he's so upset and so angry about sin? I mean, you know, it seems a little bit over the top, isn't it? Isn't he exaggerating a bit here? But what I'm going to propose is not at all. This is the doctor who is giving us the diagnosis that all of us have a terminal illness, and the terminal illness is sin. And Paul wants human beings. He wants the Greeks, he wants the Romans, he wants the Jews, he wants everybody. He's going all over the world preaching the gospel. He's so convinced of this. He wants to know the reality of the diagnosis that God has made about sin. You know, it's a terrible thing not to know reality, isn't it? I mean, we have been students or parents or individuals who haven't really known ourselves very well. It's a shocking thing to know ourselves as others see us. And it's a terrible thing when a parent or a coach or a teacher or a business leader doesn't know who they are. They create all kinds of damage around them. There's a lot of abuse that takes place. And so one of the most important things that can take place in any of our lives is for all of us to be able to face reality. Ray Cortese is the pastor to whom I'm indebted for some of these tough thoughts. He mentioned a guy or a woman by the name of Michelle Ray. And this is not in Taiwan, because Taiwan is different. This is in America. Michelle Ray said that she had daughters whose dressers were covered with soccer trophies. And yet she said, even though they had all these soccer trophies, there was no discernible ability that her children had. She said, actually, they were terrible in soccer. They didn't really have any skill. And yet they had all these trophies. Now, I know here in Taiwan, it's exactly the opposite. You don't get trophies here. You get a reprimand. You got an A-. Why did you get that minus? Couldn't you have done better? But anyway, it's not good for children not to know what reality is. There's a program that even people in the East are aware of. It is called American Idol. How many of you know American Idol? About everybody. I mean, this is too bad. It's too bad we all know about American Idol. But who is the most famous person on American Idol? What's his name? Simon Cowell. Everybody knows Simon Cowell. And what he's best known for is he is the one above everybody else who tells the truth. And he doesn't do it in a kind way. And, there are people that go on American Idol who don't have any ability, and, you know, they're kind of cranks, and it's kind of done more for comedy and everything else. But there are all kinds of people who go on American Idol, and all their lives, their parents have said, oh, you're good, you're great, and so on and so forth. And they get on American Idol, and they're told, you're not great, you're actually terrible. And people get all upset. And they go out of there in tears. I can't believe it. They said I'm terrible. My mom said I was wonderful. My dad said I was wonderful. Everybody else said I was wonderful. Simon Cowell told me I was awful. And for the first time, they come to reality. Or at least you hope that they do. And so it's an important thing for all of us to come to reality. And the church is a place. It's the only place in the world where the only, the beginning qualification of becoming a member is that you admit that you're a sinner and that you have no hope apart from His grace. And so the church is a place where we come as sinners and we come to limp along by His grace and to become increasingly conformed to the image of Christ. But what Paul is saying here is that the problem of the human race is human sin. It's called total depravity within the theological framework that we come from in this church. Alexander Solzhenitsyn, many of you wouldn't even know that name. You're too young to know that name. He wrote a number of books. He was a Russian dissident. Most of you don't even remember the fall of communism, which took place in 1991. We grew up, old people like me, concerned about the day when the nuclear bomb would fall on our places, and there were places that were built to go and run to when that took place. And Alexander Solzhenitsyn, he was a dissident. He was in prison in the Gulag. He wrote a whole bunch of books, Cancer Ward, Fourth Circle, August 1914. But one time later in his life, I think it was before the UN, he gave a speech. And it was a speech that just about floored everybody, and a lot of people didn't agree with it. I want to just share one quotation from that speech. He said, more than half a century ago, while I was still a child, I recall hearing a number of older people offering the following explanation for the great disasters that had befallen Russia. Men have forgotten God. That's why all this has happened. Since then, I have spent well nigh 50 years working on the history of our revolution. In the process, I have read hundreds of books, collected hundreds of personal testimonies, and have already contributed 8 volumes of my own toward the effort of clearing away the rubble left by that upheaval. But if I were asked today to formulate as concisely as possible the main cause of the ruinous revolution, he's speaking of the Russian Revolution, that swallowed up some 60 million of our people, I could not put it more accurately than to repeat, men have forgotten God. That's why all this happened. And that's why Paul is so ticked off. Paul isn't, he hasn't had a bad night of sleep. It isn't because he hasn't had his coffee in the morning. He understands reality. And you will never understand reality. And the gospel will never be glorious to you. And it will never change your worship and your obedience until you know that you are a hopeless sinner apart from His mercy. And so we have to bring the bad news. We got to bring it again and again. Because again, most of us won't believe it. Because when we come into the pages of the Bible, again, it's like culture shock. And so there are the depths of our depravity. And Paul outlines it here through this entire chapter. But then there's the equality of our depravity. And what do we mean by that? What Paul is saying here is, he's outlining the doctrine that we call total depravity. And we need to explain what that means. But what he's saying, what he says here again in chapter 3, verse 9, again, another very shocking thing. And he's speaking to the Jewish people. And he's particularly even speaking to religious Jewish people. He dealt with that in chapter 2, and we looked at it last week. And so what's the summation of what he says to the religious Jewish people? He says, what then? Are we better off? Not at all. And again, it's shocking. It's culture shock. Because in chapter 1, you know, he described the pagans. I mean, basically, you know, they're all guilty of sex and drugs and rock and roll. Just lays them out. And, you know, and so, you know, in chapter 2, you know, the religious people, the Jewish people and everything else, they would have been saying, go get them, Paul, you know, tell those dirty, rotten, filthy sinners who they really all are. And then Paul turns the sights upon the religious people. And he says, really, you're no better. I mean, no, you haven't done the same things, but your religiosity, your self-righteousness, your pride actually puts you in a position where you are harder to reach than they are. And we talked about that last week. And this is, again, a shocking thing, because who is the person who is writing this letter? Well, it's none other than the Apostle Paul. And who was the Apostle Paul? Well, on the one hand, he was the most scrupulous religious person that you could find. He was a Pharisee of the Pharisees. And so in Philippians chapter 3, he describes himself before he came to Christ. He said if anybody had confidence, it was him. He was circumcised on the eighth day of the people of Israel, of the tribe of Benjamin, a Hebrew of Hebrews. As to the law, a Pharisee. As to zeal, a persecutor of the church. As to righteousness, under the law, blameless. So in terms of his identity, first of all, he was the most scrupulous religious person that you could ever find. But secondarily, what was his identity? He was a member of ISIS. I mean, I'm exaggerating a little bit. That's who he was. I mean, think about it. He was ISIS, because what was he doing in his religious in his religious devotion? He was persecuting Christians, and he was thinking he was doing his duty. I think it's in Acts chapter 8 that he's standing on the sideline, but looking with approving eyes at the stoning of Stephen. That sounds like ISIS, doesn't it? Before his conversion experience, he's on his way to Damascus to do what? To capture and to imprison and to kill Christians. And so here he is, a very religious person. And a person who looked upon the Gentiles as quote-unquote dogs. That's the way they referred to them. That's what religiosity does to you. It makes you proud. It makes you judgmental. It makes you pharisaical. He looked on the Gentiles as dogs. But what has happened? He's been converted. This religious Pharisee who thought that the purpose of his life was to exterminate Christians and who looked down his nose upon Gentiles as dogs. What's he doing now? His whole life has been turned upside down. The gospel has turned him upside down. And what is he doing? He is going to the very people that he despised. He says the gospel is to the Jew and also to the Gentile. But his calling, as he discovered it, was to go to the Gentiles, to go to the people that he despised. You know what the other thing that the gospel does? And that is it rehumanizes you. And you say, well, what do I mean by that? You know, before we come to the gospel, we have all these prejudices. And there are prejudices here in Taiwan. You know it. There's racism in Taiwan. There's racism in America. People here look down upon certain people. Educated people look down upon working class people. In America, blacks look down upon whites. There's all this discrimination and this racism. People in our circles, you know, Reformed Presbyterian people, we think we have great theology. We look down upon people who don't have our theology. But one thing that the gospel does to us is it rehumanizes us because it levels all of us at the foot of the cross. And we realize that there is great sin in us and there's common grace in other people, and that we can learn from people who are different than we are. And so it rehumanizes you. It was Miroslav Volf who talked about, you know, in the Serbian war, whether each tribe was trying to wipe each other out. And he basically said the only hope is the gospel. Because he said on the one hand, the gospel, it tells you that the person who is your enemy actually is made in the image of God. And the other thing that the gospel tells you is that you're a great sinner. And so it changes your perspective. It levels you. And then it also teaches you that there is a judgment where ultimately God will not let anyone get away with anything. And so here Paul is. He has been so radically changed, and the equality of the gospel is working itself out in his life. What does Paul say about the doctrine of total depravity? What it says is that before any of us come to Christ, we are all dead. Isn't that what Ephesians chapters 1 and 2 say? It says that you were dead in your trespasses and sins before you came to Christ, that you were walking according to the course of this world, and that you were under the dominion of Satan. That's everybody. The pagans, the people who are in drugs and rock and roll, but also the religious people as well. It says we're all dead before we come to Christ. Here's an analogy that came to me. If you went to a morgue, and if in the morgue there were two bodies, and one person had died because they were killed by a venomous spider, and there was another person that was in the morgue because they were mauled by a grizzly bear, what would be the difference? Well, I mean, on the one hand, the person that had been bitten by the venomous spider, you know, their body wouldn't be ravaged. The person that had been ravaged by the grizzly bear, you know, their face may have been torn off, they may have been mangled, but when it comes to their essential condition, what is it? They're both dead. They're both dead. And that's what Paul is saying, is that we're all dead apart from Christ. And so he says in verse 9, he says, all, both Jew and Greek, are under sin. None is righteous. No, not one. No one understands. No one seeks for God. And religion doesn't make it any better. You know, if you get a chance, there was a chapter at the end of Tim Keller's book on questioning Christianity. That isn't the exact title, but at the end of his book, he actually referenced a story, a book that was written by a gentleman by the name of Langdon Gilkey. It was called Chantung Compound. And those of you in Asia, in your history, you would have read about this. These were the days of the Japanese occupation in China. And he talked about a time there where there were all these people that were herded into this compound. And there were only a few toilets for everybody, and there was just a little bit of space. And you know, he actually had kind of a secular humanist view that, you know, people are basically good. And that you didn't really need religion, you certainly didn't need the gospel, that people were basically good. And he thought, you know, that when everybody was shoved into this compound where he was, that people would work together. And he said at the beginning they did do that, that they organized themselves into different kind of groups. There was even a group in the evening who were, you know, like actors and so forth, and they would put on plays at night. But he said over time, everything began to break down. And the basic selfishness that was in every person's heart began to come out. And he said it wasn't just the people who weren't believers. He said there were priests and there were missionaries that were also bad. And so at the end of it, he said, you know, I came to the conclusion, first of all, that people were not basically good, that in the heart of hearts, people were basically evil. It's only because we live comfortable lives that the evil doesn't come out. But when we lose the comfort, the sin rises to the surface. But then as he reflects upon things, he says basically, human beings aren't basically good. Irreligion certainly doesn't work. Being religious in itself doesn't work. But he says this at the end. He said, religion is not the place where the problem of man's egotism is automatically solved. Rather, it is there that the ultimate battle between human pride and God's grace takes place. Insofar as human pride may win the battle, religion can and does become one of the instruments of human sin. But insofar as there the self meets God, and so can surrender to something beyond its own self-interest, religion may provide the one possibility for a much-needed and very rare release from our common self-concern. Now, let me paraphrase that for you, because I'm sure you didn't get it. He said, I don't know what the answer is. He said, irreligion didn't work in the compound. Religion didn't work. But he said, you know, maybe if you went outside, if you would really came into contact with God, if there is a God, maybe that God would dislodge yourself. And then he goes on and he says, there was one guy there. One guy who really struck me. You know what his name was? Eric Liddell. Remember Eric Liddell? Chariots of Fire. It dates me. How many of you have seen Chariots of Fire? At least a few of you. You know, the great Scottish missionary who was the great Olympic runner. Yeah, I have to go back. It's one of my favorite movies of all time. Many people don't know that Eric Liddell died in that same prison camp. And Gilkey looked on at Eric Liddell and he said, that guy was different. You know, he worked with the young people. There was a quality of selflessness about him that just kind of bowled us all over. Why was Eric Liddell different? Because he had met the God, namely Jesus Christ, who was able to dislocate him from the narcissistic preoccupation with self. And that's what has to happen to us. Something has to deal with ourself. We're all, in different ways, narcissistic. And so Paul says, nobody seeks for God. He has all these quotations he strings together from the Old Testament. No one understands. No one seeks for God. They've all turned aside. No one does good. Their throat is an open grave. The venom of asps is under their lips. Their feet are swift to shed blood. On and on and on. He says three things about us. Our character is corrupt. Our conversation is corrupt. And thirdly, our conduct is corrupt. And so that is the equality of our depravity. And you say, okay, well, is there some good news in here? Please help me. Give me some good news. And there is some good news. And it's the cure for sin, the cure for depravity. And we'll look at that more in future weeks. Do you notice what he says here? He says, there is no one who seeks God. Not really. We invent different kind of gods here in Taiwan. There are millions of gods. Even in evangelical churches, we invent visions of God that are not the real God. It says no one is seeking for God. And so the question is, if nobody is seeking for God, well, how does somebody come to know God? Well, the answer is that, well, maybe he is seeking us. Have you ever thought about that? That maybe he is seeking us. That is the story of the Bible. Remember Adam and Eve when they fall away from God? You know, and they're making excuses and they're putting fig leaves on themselves to try to cover up their nakedness. Who comes looking for them? God comes looking for them. And there is a sacrifice that's made and they are clothed with animals, which looks down to the time when Jesus will die upon the cross. In 2 Timothy 2, verse 25, it says that God may perhaps grant that they will repent and come to the knowledge of truth. How do any of us come to God? It's because he comes to us and gives to us the gift of salvation. And so you say, okay, well, what do we do? You know, this is all bad news. What do we do? The Philippian jailer says, what do we need to be saved? And Paul tells us in the rest of the passage two things. He tells us to start by shutting up. And secondly, to cultivate the fear of God. Let's just take a moment to talk about that. First of all, he tells us to shut up. You say, where is that? Verse 19, now we know that whatever the law says, it speaks to those who are under the law, so that every mouth may be stopped and the whole world may be held accountable to God. And so what do we begin by doing? We stop with our excuse making. we say, oh, but you don't understand God. There were extenuating circumstances. And he says to us, shut up. He says, well, did I say the right words? Maybe if I say the right words, God will just get off my back. And God says, shut up. We say, well, give me another chance. And God says, shut up. And why is that? Because you can never be saved until you come to the end of yourself, until you come to the end of your excuse-making, until you just stand, you know, as a hopeless sinner before the presence of God. But then he talks about something else, which is a hint of what we will look at in the weeks to come. He talks about the fear of God. In verse 16, he says, there is no fear of God before their eyes. Now you say, well, what does the fear of God mean? Well, again, I have to be very, very brief here because our time is really gone. The fear of God, first of all, if you're not a Christian, it means that you really should be afraid of God, because if you don't come to Jesus and his righteousness, you will be eternally separated from him. But for those of us who are Christians, and for those of you that long to become Christians, there's some other passages that tell us what the fear of God is. Deuteronomy 10 says, what does the Lord require of you but to fear him and to love him and to serve him with all your heart and all your soul? In Psalm 119, it says, because you fulfill your promise to me, I fear you. And maybe one of the best passages in Psalms, it says, because you have forgiven me, I fear you. And so what is the fear of God? I can only just kind of just mention it here. But what it simply means is that when you come to the cross, I mean, on the one hand, you are just humbled into the dust because of your sin. But on the other hand, you are lifted up because you realize that this great God, for reasons that you don't understand, has knit his heart to you, and that he wants to have you back, and that he actually loves you, and that he's gone from heaven and earth to be able to get you back. I've got to wrap this up, but let me just share just one thing, a little illustration that came to me this past week. Again, for reasons that I don't understand, God has bound his heart with ours. I know as a pastor, the people my heart gets bound up with the most are people who have shared their sins and their weaknesses with me, and you cannot but, you know, feel a connection with them that is beyond the ordinary. I heard this story. It was about a dog who came home one day, and the dog's face had swollen to 3 times its size. And the master took the dog to a veterinarian. And as the veterinarian looked at the dog, he noticed that there were 3 holes in the dog's face. And he said, this dog has been attacked by a copperhead snake. That's a venomous snake. And so the veterinarian applied antibiotics. And the dog's condition was terrible. There was infection and pus that was coming out of its nostrils. It had infected the nasal passages. There was ooze that came out of the dog's face, and it was so awful, it smelled so terrible, that it was very difficult for the master to take the antiseptic and to apply it to the dog's face. The dog smelled so bad that he had to put the dog in the garage. And he was just the most stinking, ugly dog that you could possibly imagine. But in time, the dog began to heal. And there were scars all over his face afterward. But you know something that happened? That dog became so devoted to that master. Whenever the master would go hunting, the dog would be there by his side. Before the master would go off to work, the dog would be there as he went off to work. The dog would sleep in the same bedroom with the master. And so what had happened there? And that is, this ugly, stinking dog had been loved so much by the master that it was that dog's greatest desire to be able to love and serve that master in every way that he could. The Bible teaches that we also got into a fight with a snake, the serpent, and that the fangs went deep into our heart and into our lives. But that into that situation, there was a master who was willing to do anything that would cost him, anything that it would cost us, to come and rescue us. That's our Savior, and we'll learn more about him next week. Amen.